Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. The new screensavers is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With a built-in HD camera and microphone, you can monitor your front door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like being home, even when you're not. Right now, get $10 off the Ring Video Doorbell when you go to ring.com/NSS. And by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. Save 50% off a 12-month subscription. Go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code NSS50 at checkout.
3D printed hearts, live from IFA. And what's so special about Intel's new Skylake CPUs? Live from the Twit Brick House in beautiful downtown Petaluma, it's the new Screensavers.
I'm Father Robert Ballester.
And we are here to help you with your computer.
Things.
We used to say that, you know.
Yeah.
Fixing the world one computer at a time. That's like, we haven't saved the world one computer at a time in a long time.
We'll put your ones and zeros in the right order.
That's better. I like that. Robert, of course, is not only a member of the Society of Jesuits, but he is also the digital Jesuit. He is one of our favorite show hosts on This Week in Enterprise. You do more shows than I do, practically. This Week in Enterprise Tech, Coding 101, Know How.
Before you buy.
And
of course this.
Busy man. Anyways, great to have you. I'm sorry, he drove up from the South Bay, or San Francisco.
From San Francisco. How long did it take? I left when you started the tech guy. So it was about 4 hours to get up
here. Oh.
But it's a Saturday. It's Labor Day. There's a lot of people gawking on the bridge.
It's crazy. Well, anyway, we're glad you're here. Welcome. Thanks also to Chris from Morgan Hill. He also came up a long way. Chris, thank you for that announce. You did a great job reading the open. Chris, as you might have noticed, was wearing a LinkedIn T-shirt. And so what do you do at LinkedIn?
I'm a software engineer.
Software engineer.
Nice. And we also have an Aussie.
We have an Aussie in-house.
Yeah, we always find out who came the furthest. So there we go.
So this is going to be a big show. Intel announced their new Skylake CPUs, at least gave us more details about those Skylake CPUs this week. We've got Ian Cuttrist from Anontech in to talk about that. That's going to be great. We also will talk with a children's hospital that's doing something very cool with 3D printing. Before they do open-heart surgery on kids' hearts, very small, very difficult to work on, they make a 3D model of it for the surgeon. We have some of those models, and we'll talk about how they do that, how they get the picture. What happens to the data, the mystery data that you lose when you compress an MP3? You know, when you make an MP3, you're tearing little bits out of it. Bits, they say, are inaudible. What does it sound like if you took those bits and just those bits and played them?
Well, Leo, that's why the audiophiles insist that the old analog recordings sound better because all the bits are there. They may have some interference.
This is what you're missing.
You're missing something.
So if you've ever wondered why an analog recording sounds better, this is what you're missing. We'll play those for you. But let's start with IFA because that's the big trade show. It's a radio show started in the 20s in Berlin. Is now, of course, mostly about technology, computers, and very much mobile phones. Joining us from Slash Gear, he was at IFA in Berlin, Chris Davies. Hi, Chris.
Hey, guys. I'm actually still in Berlin.
So, nice.
I could show you. Well, I could show you out the window if it wasn't the middle of the night.
Well, thanks for staying up late. We should explain that IFA is really weird because we've been covering IFA all week, but it's only just begun.
It literally started yesterday. today is the kind of the big day, Saturday, when all of the families come out. It's one of the only trade shows, big trade shows at least, where the general public is invited in. So there's a couple of press days, and then on Friday, everyone is allowed to come. They sell tickets to it, and it's terrifying, absolutely terrifying.
Do you kind of want to stay off the show floor today?
You really do. Yeah. You do, which is a shame because there's a huge amount to see. It's certainly the biggest trade show in Europe, kind of rivalry every year with CES. It's huge, and not just phones and tablets, as you said, but also a variety of white goods, more fridge freezers with Wi-Fi built in than you might ever want to see.
So we did do live coverage of the early press events earlier this week, starting with a Samsung event. There was a Microsoft event. What did you see that you were impressed by, or what have you seen that you've been impressed by so far, Chris?
Well, there's been a huge amount of smartwatches, as seems to have been the trend over the past couple of years. Huawei brought out the smartwatch, which is pretty beautiful, actually. You know, it's one of the closest we've seen that's gotten to a traditional watch design.
That's an Android Samsung Wear watch, too, right?
That's right, yes. Yeah. But it will be one of the first to work with iPhone,
right?
Ever since Google announced Android Wear for iOS. Samsung then brought out the Gear S2, which is one of its Tizen smartwatches. And this is another beautiful watch with a really interesting interface design where they've kind of given it this active bezel where you can scroll through by twisting the bezel forward and backwards, and it will navigate through the circular display. It's a really nice design.
I think there was some fear when
there,
Apple...
in fact, is my thumb.
That's your thumb, ladies and gentlemen.
That's my very thumb, yes. I recognize it.
There was some, I think, some concern when Apple came out with the Apple Watch that would be it, that Apple would own the market, much as they did in the early smartphone days. But in fact, it isn't dominant in the market. It's not even the number one selling fitness or smart band. So there is room, and I'm glad to see other companies trying to compete.
Well, Chris, I want to get your input on this, because IDC recently put out some numbers saying that when Apple, like you said, when they announced their watch, there was a huge burst in buzz. But when it came time for people to actually buy, most consumers were buying the cheaper options, the Fitbit-style devices. And even that is starting to peter down. And people are starting to wonder, is this wearables hype really just hype? I mean, it's probably not going to die, but it doesn't sound like it should be the focus of a major show like IFA. And yet it sounds like that's the majority of the news that you're hearing over there.
Well, I think when Apple came into the market, it certainly validated the idea of wearables, and it validated the idea of a watch as a form factor. But they certainly targeted a more well-heeled audience. You know, it starts at $350, $399 for the regular-sized one, you could say. You know, it's not chump change, especially when people are used to paying very little for a smartphone. The idea of paying maybe twice as much as that, on paper at least, for an accessory for that smartphone is kind of a lot. So I think we're still very early days for that. If you looked back to kind of the beginning of the smartphone era, you might have said the same thing about that. Do we really need to have email on a smartphone? You know, do we really need to have a QWERTY keyboard? But you're right that, you know, that there was a kind of a push of people towards these fitness trackers. And we have seen some more affordable smartwatches this week as well. ASUS brought out the Zen Watch 2, which is $150. Alcatel has the Go Watch, which is, I think, going to be under 100 euros. It's more like a G-Shock kind of with some smartwatch features. I think it's still very early. People haven't quite decided what they want a smartwatch to do and whether it's really worth strapping one to their wrist. So I'm glad that we're seeing some interesting ideas and kind of more experimentative things.
I think it's actually important that people haven't figured out what they want to do with their smartwatch yet for companies like Samsung, because they've got that Tizen, however you want to pronounce it, which is definitely running third. It's a distant third. Is that indecision going to possibly help Samsung? Does Samsung know something that we don't about what people might want to do with their watches?
I'm pretty sure that Samsung knows a lot of things that I don't. Whether they know anything about smartwatches.
I thought the Gear 2 was actually a pretty good smartwatch, but the Tizen scared me away. Yeah. I want to go Android with it. Now, this is your thumb again. Is that this bezel rotating when you do thumb. That? Is that the bezel? Yeah. So the UI...
It is. So, as you...
Go ahead.
Yes, as you hold it, the UI is circular, so the icons run around the edge of the screen, and as you twist the bezel around, it moves the highlighted one around, and you tap the screen to select it, and then as you're moving through the different menus, you just kind of swipe around. And it's hard to tell from the pictures, even with my incredible thumb sort of illustrating that, but what my thumb doesn't show you is quite how nice and tactile that feel is. I'm a fiddler. I like to fiddle with, like... the digital crown on my Apple Watch while I'm in a meeting or while I'm watching TV. And I'd say the S2's kind of bezel comes about as close to that kind of tactile feel as the digital crown does. Whether that's important to anyone else other than me, I don't know. But if Samsung's going to make me more devices, that's great.
Yeah, I think it's important because I think we haven't, one of the things we haven't licked in the wristwatch is the UI and the controls. Yeah. I feel like the Apple is a little fiddly.
It still feels like they're taking a smartwatch and trying to shrink it.
I can't quite get it to work. So I'm I'd be very interested to try that that bezel. Samsung also, as you said, is into the appliance market. What'd you call them? The white things? The refrigerators?
White goods.
Is that what they call them?
That's how they call them. Yeah, what they call them in Europe. White goods.
I call our, in America, I think we call them avocado and burnt orange goods. But it's the same idea. Those are the refrigerators, the dishwashers. Samsung recently acquired SmartThings. We should say a disclaimer. They're an advertiser on Twit. And so they're trying to integrate smart home stuff with their appliances. Did you see some of that on the show floor? And by the way, just because they're an advertiser, you could say negative things. That's fine.
Actually, I'm a SmartThings fan. I really like the system. They announced their second generation home hub. With video monitoring. It's been up for pre-sale in the US for a couple of weeks now. It's just started shipping this past week. It's coming to the UK next week. And it's very interesting. They've listened a lot to the kind of the concerns and complaints and feedback from the early adopters who backed the Kickstarter and have bought it since then. And they've also looked at trying to kind of dig into some of that Samsung R&D budget and maybe make it suitable for a broader audience, you know, the kind of people who might be looking to replace their existing house alarm, perhaps with something which they can access from their phone or that they want to be able to check in on their pets during the day. And so there are a lot of the kind of things like that about the new hub, which are going to make it a lot more stable. And I think are going to really please some of the early adopters.
You know, you can make a better hub, but do people, I'm still wondering about home automation, if there really is a market for that. Obviously, Microsoft thinks so. With the Xbox One. Google thinks so with that new on-hub router. Apple definitely thinks so. Their new Apple TV, which reputedly will come out on Wednesday, is apparently a hub, much like the SmartThings hub. So all the companies are behind it. But so I guess the question is, why haven't people adopted the smart home? Is it that it's too complicated and one of these companies is going to solve it, or that nobody really cares about their lights coming on when they walk in the door and the garage door closing and opening on command? Which is it?
I think at the moment it's very geeky, you know, and you have to be a bit of a geek to appreciate it. And, you know, it's difficult to set up. It's hard to know what will work with what. And we've seen kind of movements by things like Apple with HomeKit and that sort of stuff, trying to, you know, decide what will work together so that you can go into a hardware store and pick up something off the shelf and know that when you get it home, it's going to work. And you just have to plug it in and it will do it. I think there's that honeymoon period where you install something and you have an app on your phone and you realize, wow, I can control my lights, or I can control my lights while I'm sat in the bath, or from my watch while I'm away. But I think it only really starts to make sense when you don't have to start to control it yourself, where the house kind of reacts around you. So when I come home, I don't have to think about, well, where are the lights coming on? I just move around and the lights follow me around.
That may be the answer. You're right.
I think we're in that period that's sort of like that episode of The Big Bang Theory where they've got their lights hooked up to the internet, which it's interesting. It's cool, but most people don't want to do it. It's going to be them solving things like, how about if I get a text when my washer and my dryer are done?
That doesn't feel like a problem that needs to be solved.
It's not a problem, but we don't know what the problems do need to be solved.
I'm starting to think that this actually is not going to take off. This category is a dead category. It's too hard. It's crazy. I had Hue lights. I had a Nest thermostat. When I moved, I didn't bother to reinstall it. It's like, you know, I don't really care. And I also think that concerns about privacy and security with the Internet of Things might actually scare people off of a category they're not completely sold on in the first place. So I'm starting to think, I'm going to hold off, but I'm starting to think maybe the smart home isn't so smart.
You want your house off the grid, don't you?
Yeah. I'll give you an example. I bought the on-hub router, the Google router. Then I read Ron Amadio's review in Ars Technica, the wire cutter review, in which both of which said, this isn't really a very good router. It's about half the speed of our Asus routers. It's really a home automation device that doesn't yet do anything, that it's a stealth device. And I canceled my order because I don't need a home automation device. I wanted a really good router. I ended up buying the Asus, the AC3200.
Oh, that's nice.
Six antennas, great router. And then Asus announces a new one. Tell us about that one, Chris.
Well, yes, there's been what seems like an arms race or a legs race, I should say, of routers with multiple antennas. We've seen one this week that looked like a crown of thorns from Lord of the Rings. Soon there is going to be more antennas on routers than devices connecting to them wirelessly. You'll have an antenna each.
That's eight antennas.
It's incredible. You could cosplay with that. It's fantastic.
It could be a great hat.
The specs are fantastic.
I don't know. They are. To be fair, it's an incredible router. It probably will be very fast. They're talking about the increased range there. It's Wi-Fi AC. It will be an amazing router. I do wonder, whether people will be put off by the fact that it looks like it will creep up on you in the night and smother you or bite you and keep your bedroom door locked.
It looks like that face, the face creature from...
That's right. Oh!
From Half-Life. It's going to go... It's a facehugger. Did you go to the Microsoft event on Friday, Chris?
I did go to the Microsoft event on Friday, and I had a lot of fun there. They didn't announce a huge lot. They gave a couple of teasers of some upcoming Windows 10 laptops, but they did have an amazing demonstration by one of the Windows product managers, Brian Roper, and I couldn't help but live blog that over on Twitter because he was wearing this incredible hat.
Were they giving those hats away as freebies? Because that would be a selling point for me. That thing is amazing. It's incredible.
That would get me to upgrade to Windows 10, though funnily enough, Microsoft weren't, but over in the Samsung booth, they did have some Samsung hats very similar, and I was tempted to pick one up. But I have a surprisingly large head, and I have trouble finding hats that fit me. So,
Did we tell you that we have no shortage of hats here at Twit TV?
Go ahead, tweet about this, Chris Davies. Tweet about this. I hope you are having a great time at IFA. I hope you continue to have fun. Come back and report more on slashgear.com. We look forward to your thumb and other parts of your body demonstrating some lovely... Two thumbs up for Chris Davies. Thank you, Chris. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Take care. Get some sleep. He stayed up late for that one. Wow. I am very happy with that AC3200, by the way.
They're very nice. And this new one, it does beamforming. It does up to 1 gig over 2.4, up to 5.6 gig over 5 gigahertz.
I think Asus is knocking it out of the park with routers. And they did their own version of DDWRT, Asus WRT, but they've also made sure that their routers are easily modified with third-party firmware. There's a guy named Merlin who's created his own version of the Asus firmware. You could put Tomato on it. You could put DDWRT on it. That, to me, is the router of choice. If you're a geek, the Google router, it's easy. You use an app, and you can hardly configure it at all. So I realized I'm not going to buy into this home automation thing. When they make it do something, maybe I'll buy one. But right now, I'm so happy with the 3200.
Yeah.
That is a great router. Hey, let's get our first call for help. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
I think you look good in that hat. Why don't you take it off? Here's Kiro Dragoon joining us. Hello, Kiro! Hey, I love your name, Kiro. Is that your real name, Kiro Dragoon?
No, it's just my online name.
It's an awesome name. Awesome.
Sounds like a mech warrior name, actually.
Are you a mech warrior?
No.
Oh.
Just online stuff.
Kiro, what can we do for you?
I am wondering if you can help me with my old Zune.
Whoa!
Wow.
Whoa!
I have never actually seen one in the wild, so thank you very much.
It has error code 5, and it has had this error code 5 for, 6 years. it's been a paperweight in my house, and I have the last produced Zune.
The HD was a nice one, actually. That was great.
Oh, yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, I had that one, too.
I'm wondering if there's any way to revive this.
Well, the problem is...
I've seen online is just... some person just wiggling wires around, closing it, and miraculously it works.
You've got an error code 5, but you've only had it for error code 5, but you've only had it for what, 6 years or 5 years, or is it backwards? I'm not sure. 6 years.
I got this back when the original screensavers was around.
Oh, okay. So that error code tells you that the Zune, the motherboard's actually fine.
I know it. I'm just looking it up.
It's having trouble.
It means you should have bought a better player. I could.
That's official. No, so it's having difficulty talking to the hard drive. Now, that could be a couple of things. The first thing, and this is why you see those videos with people jiggling around the cables. After that much time...
It could be just a loose cable.
Yeah, it's a zero insertion force cable, so it can get knocked out by vibration. So you could open it up, and there's actually some very good tutorials on how you crack these things open. And just play around with them. Maybe clean it out a little bit and try to reinsert it. There's also the possibility, very good possibility, that the hard drive has actually died. It's a moving part, and anything that moves will die after time.
Kira, what have you done to fix it before we get to that? Anything?
I have actually replaced the cord inside, and no avail. I think the hard drive is
fried. Did you rewrite the firmware? Because that's the other thing.
I am tech illiterate in that situation.
Okay, so that's one thing. But let's replace the hard drive.
They're super cheap. If you go to Amazon right now, you can buy a 1.8-inch Toshiba drive, the exact same one that came in that Zune, for about $15.
Are they still making them?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, they have to.
Those are new?
And hey, how about this? If you want to, you could upgrade to an 80-gigabyte hard drive for about $40.
Wow.
So this could be an opportunity to get all the musics.
The one we're looking at was not new. It was a refurbished
That
one.
Is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I also have one more thing to show you guys.
Uh-oh. This isn't chat room.
My
God. I love that. That's the old Tech TV logo on your Moto 360.
Wait, it dances?
And he's using the new Moto 360 software. It turns into the Twit logo.
It transforms into the Twit logo.
Yep.
Nice.
Very cool.
Kiro, you clearly have a lot of time on your hands, and I think that's...
Actually, that took 15 minutes.
No, that's great. I really... would you send me the files so I can put it on my Moto 360? That's awesome.
It's very glitchy. It doesn't show the battery life properly, so I don't know if you'd want that.
Did you do it with some existing software, or did you do your own?
FaceMaker.
FaceMaker's great.
Yeah. Wait a bit. You're worried about it being very glitchy. You do understand that this is Twit TV, right? I mean, we're
glitchy
totally
are
okay
us.
With that. We're fine.
We
send
are
that
glitchy.
On in.
Put it up on
I'll
the repo.
Try to send it.
Put it on the FaceMaker repo so everybody can see it.
Oh, definitely.
That's great. Hey, really nice to meet you, Kiro. Oh, did we say how to? We have an iFixit. Believe it or not, the folks at iFixit are amazing. Another sponsor, but we have great sponsors, so we should mention them. They've already put up a guide, step-by-step guide for replacing that hard drive in the Zune, believe it or not, on the iFixit.com website. That's we had showed it earlier, but there I just wanted to show it again. That is, they say, 5 to 8 minutes. You might want to get some spudgers. That means the iFixit toolkit, which if you do any of this stuff is really handy, about $50.
Well, just so you don't mar the case. You don't want to have to just chew it up in order to open it.
Yeah, it's already been opened.
Okay.
It's
spudged. Okay. Too bad you didn't have the brown one. Now, that one would be worth something.
The Zune Brown?
Brown Zune.
Just for ironic effect.
Yeah. Hey, it's great to talk to you. And I hope I see you in the chat room and you continue to participate with us
here. Thank you very much.
It's nice. Obviously a fan from a long...
Thank you for bringing back the show.
Yeah.
I love it.
You're very welcome. We do, too.
I was a fan from the show, and I found the show about a couple months before it went off the air.
Oh.
So you didn't get all
and
the
I
good
was
fun.
So incredibly upset. It became my favorite show, and I'm so glad you guys are back.
Oh, Kiro, thank you so much. Yeah, it's fun. You know, what we wanted on Twit was, first of all, we needed to have the facilities to do it, the staff to do it, and it took us a while to get to that point. But we also, it was a perfect to do a variety show because it gives us a chance to do a lot of stuff that we wouldn't necessarily want to do a whole, you know, every week show about. And we're going to have a lot of fun in weeks to come. We've got a lot of great things planned. Thanks, Kiro.
Thank you.
Take care. Coming up, Intel officially launches their new family of CPUs. It's Skylake. Is it a tick or is it a talk? We'll find out. We're going to talk about it in a bit. We'll get down to the nano level with Ian Cutress from NandTech. But first, a word about my doorbell. Do you use this at all, Ring doorbell?
Are you kidding me? I put this in my parents' home. That's how much I trust
it. I love the Ring doorbell. I could show you the Ring app on my phone. So the idea is this is a Wi-Fi connected doorbell. It's a perfect in-place replacement for your existing wired doorbell. We had, you know, I took the old doorbell off. We had, as many of you will, a hole in the wall and two wires coming out. They have all the instructions and videos. And what I love about the kit, it even comes with the tools you'll need. Drill bits, screwdriver bits, everything you need, including, and I'll show you this, inside here, there's a regular Phillips bit, but there's also a proprietary bit. That's the bit you use to attach the Ring doorbell. And I'll tell you why you might want to detach it, because it also can be used on a non-wired doorbell. You could mount it on any wall, and it has a lithium-ion year-long battery, a USB charger on the back, and it's attached with a proprietary connector so that no one could come and just, you know, unscrew your doorbell. You're going to love the Ring doorbell. Not only does it sound great, and if you have a wired system, it will work automatically, bring your chimes and so forth, but once you hook it up to your Wi-Fi system, now you can answer the door from anywhere. Now, I'm not talking unlock it. They don't do that, but you can literally talk to the person at your door. Even if you're at work, you could say, hey, what is it? And oh, I'm in the bathtub. I'll be right there. That'll chase away a crook. Did you see the report in KTLA did this? They caught the guys. Guy had a Ring video doorbell. Bad guys came, robbed his house. He had video of them, called the cops. They apprehended the guys, got all his stuff back thanks to the Ring video doorbell. This is an amazing...
Done.
It's buy this doorbell. Go right now to ring.com/NSS. You'll save $10 off. It's easy. It's a great project for the, you know, an hour in the afternoon. Everybody will thank you for it. You do need to have Wi-Fi, we should say that. And what is also great about this is it has a motion detector. So when people come and go, I know somebody's just been to my house. The doorbell goes off. It does these nice chimes when the doorbell goes off so that I know somebody's ringing the doorbell. This is our front door. And I can see, that's just kids who've come up to ring my doorbell, right? Get away from, hey, kids, get off of my lawn. Get up, go. Oh, I swear, they think it's so funny. Get out of there, you. Anyway, it is a great security device. It's great fun.
That got dark.
That was blood curdling. Now, that's Scarlett, our neighbor across the street. She's about 7 years old, and she has a blood curdling scream.
Yes, she does.
She does, and she likes to employ it at all times. But see, because of the video, I know nothing's going on. They're just fooling around, the silly kids. They're just silly. Anyway, ring.com/NSS. If you don't have the Ring doorbell, you got to get the Ring doorbell. We'll give you $10 off when you use ring.com/NSS. All right, coming up in just a little bit, we're going to get an inside look at the new Skylake processors. But first, Frederick Van Johnson with a little photographic tip.
Hi there, my name is Frederick Van Johnson. I'm the host of This Week in Photo. You can find us at thisweekinphoto.com. This is a quick tip about how to instantly make your photography or your photographs better. All you got to do is change your perspective. 90% of the people on the planet stand up and take a picture from eye level. If you just shift your perspective a little bit, like crouch down or get up high, put the camera above your head, aiming down, do something that you don't normally see. And when folks look at your photographs, they see a slightly different perspective than they would normally see in their daily lives. And that's my tip.
Trying to get up here and get an unusual photographic...
I don't like this. This is bad.
Is this a bad idea?
I need an adult.
All right, Thank you, Frederick Van Johnson. Hey, I got an adult. Here's a guy with a PhD, Ian Cutress. He's on the line joining us right now. Hello, Ian.
Hello, sir. How are you?
All the way from the UK, which means you are also up very late. Thank you.
That's correct. Almost midnight.
Oh, Ian writes at Anontech, and you did an excellent, superb job filling us in on Skylake. So we had Haswell, we had Broadwell, and now we have Skylake. Is this a tick or a tock? I can never remember. There it is. Look at that. Ooh.
It's a Skylake. Skylake is a tock, which in Intel's terminology means that this is a completely new architecture, still on the same 14-nanometer process that Broadwell was.
Don't they try to do it on a new process on the tocks? But maybe not.
No, so tick.
Tick is a new process.
It's a new process node, yes. So going from 22 nanometers down to 14 nanometers and hopefully 10 nanometers sometime in the future. But obviously going down those process nodes, it does take a lot of research and development and engineering and trying to break the laws of physics.
Right.
So it gets expensive. This is why a lot of other manufacturers are currently still at 28 nanometer and moving slowly to 16 nanometer. Intel's currently ahead of everybody on that regard.
14 nanometers, how big is that?
That big.
Really small. 14 billionths of a meter. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling that they can get that. This small. Why are they? Is it just to pack more transistors on a chip?
So, well, when you move down a process node, you typically reduce the voltage required to work the transistor, and you also reduce the leakage. the energy lost from the transistor. So moving to a smaller transistor reduces power. It also means you can put more transistors and more CPUs onto a wafer. So when Intel or TSMC, they make a wafer of CPUs, they would typically try and fit as many on as they can. And if you can fit in more, your costs go down. So there are benefits to going to that lower process node.
It's really kind
and
of...
there we go.
But the amazing thing that has fueled the microprocessor revolution is this amazing ability to get them smaller and smaller. George Gilder wrote a great book called Microcosm, in which he says this is the opposite right. of the way things normally work. To get them smaller means they're more efficient, less costly. In every way, this is an improvement. That's pretty remarkable. So we aren't getting a new process this time. It's still roughly the same process,
14
right?
Nanometer.
14 nanometer process.
But Ian, quick question about that. When I've seen Intel jump architectures before, I've typically seen a noticeable increase in efficiency per clock cycle. So more instructions per clock cycle. I was reading your report. We didn't really get that much of a jump this time. What was it? 3.5, maybe up to 5%?
It was around 3% from Broadwell, 6% from Haswell. But what we tested actually sort of, because Intel only released the high level processors at the time, we didn't get half the story. So when Intel designs a processor, they typically, the same as anybody who designs a processor, you typically design it for a specific power window. So when AMD develops Carrizo, they develop it for 15 watts. And now with Skylake, the team in Israel who were tasked to design the processor, they had to design it all the way from 4.5 watts up to 91 watts. Also still have the same core design that will also go into future enterprise processors. So that's a hell of a task. So as a result of that, you have to put in features that both will help the low-end notebooks, the 4.5-watt processors, but also help the servers. And that's a very difficult task to balance.
It's really a remarkable range, 4 watts to 90-plus watts. Is that unprecedented?
In the last architecture, Broadwell, they also did 4.5 watts with Core M, all the way up to 95 watts on some of the Xeons. And we're also going, when they come with the server products, we expect that to go even higher. But with the server products, they obviously chop and change some of the hardware features to suit those markets.
Intel's slide calls it the most scalable ever, but I guess that's a little bit of marketing.
Well, how does that fit with Intel's normal mobile first? Because this isn't mobile first. This is mobile as one, but we'll do all the processors first.
I walked away. I'll stand here for a while.
They're still focusing this processor first at the notebooks. That much is pretty obvious. They've done a number of enhancements on the notebook side, especially relating to power. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty of architecture, they've also put in a lot of effort into expanding the execution window of code. So when the processor gets a bunch of commands which converts into its own micro operations, they've increased the window so they can essentially do more at once. But the way the design is, it's also more efficient to do those at once. So the reason why we saw such a small increase in our review is because our workloads weren't necessarily beneficial to those specific advancements. So Intel essentially is catering more to specific markets with each generational upgrade. So overall upgrades can be harder to obtain. Also, don't forget that Intel doesn't have much competition in this space, so they don't need to put out all the stops every single generation.
That's kind
that
of
might change with AMD and Zen, but we'll see next year.
We used to have a competitive marketplace with AMD, and they've kind of been left in the dust of late. I hope they do come back. What about the gamer? You said that they want to reach a bunch of markets. They are offering a couple of overclockable versions of this chip, aren't they?
That's correct. So the first release was two processors on August the 5th. They launched these at Gamescom. Now, in previous years, Intel normally launches them at the Intel Developer Forum, which is mid-September. But for the past couple of years, they've now been releasing their overclock processors, at least, at gamers' events. This is despite the fact you can't actually buy them. after the event, you still have to wait a few weeks before it actually makes it onto the shelves. But they want to help the gamer because the gaming market is one of the very few consumer computing and desktop markets that is still growing. But by most metrics, the gamers are the ones that want to buy machines but you have two different types of gamer in that regard. You have those that play the esports games on machines around, say, $600. They're typically, you know, the under 25s, those who are still in school, those in their first jobs. And then you have people like us, over 25, they've been working for a few years, and maybe they want to spend their bonus, maybe a couple of $1,000 on a system. So Intel has to cater to the, both right. those gamers. But the processors they launched at Gamescom were just for that upper crowd.
I'm a little disappointed by the Intel marketing hype on this one. Most scalable ever? No. They also say faster compared to your five-year-old computer. They're not comparing that to the most recent generation of processors. They're comparing it to a five-year-old computer.
Well, they have to do that because if you look at the how many PCs there are in the world, 500 million of them are 4 to 5 years old and older. So if they can get even a small proportion of those people to upgrade, either through feature set or through generational increases, then it's financial sense. And Intel is a business who wants to please their shareholders, as every business will want to do. So if they can snab a portion of that market, that helps their bottom line. And if you sell 100 billion processors, then somebody's getting a bonus.
They also said, and this sounded like hype, but you can tell me if it's wrong, that they worked closely with Microsoft to design this processor for Windows 10.
So that's correct.
All right.
One of the new features with the Skylake, especially on the mobile side, is a new power-saving feature called Speed Step. And this allows the operating system to give control of the processor power back to the processor itself. And this allows it to essentially change speed a lot quicker.
We've had Speed Step for a while.
Sure, but this changes the ability to change speed from 30 milliseconds down to 1 millisecond.
Oh, ooh.
So say you have a fairly bursty workload that doesn't always require full CPU speed all the time. Or if you do have full CPU speed, you've got maybe a set of instructions that are waiting on main memory. If you can power down parts of your CPU to use less power, either by voltage or either by turning it off completely, then that has major benefits in battery life. And as we all know, the mobile platform battery life is the key market there, you know, enabling the experiences, to use the Intel marketing term. But experiences are what this decade is all about. So that's one thing we didn't see in our review of Skylake, the overclocking process. This is the fact that the power features in Skylake are really, you know, sort of the headline when it comes to Skylake. And we'll see that more as the devices come out. And in order to get this speed shift, this down to 1 millisecond change, you do need Windows 10. And update for it actually came out a couple of days ago.
Let me ask you about that, because I've heard that it works fine with Windows 10, works fine with Windows 8.1, works fine with Windows 8, but may not work as well with Windows 7 as you would like. And it seems as if Intel's now partnering with Microsoft to say, hey, you really should make the move to Windows 10.
Are you specifically referring to speed shift or just installation of the operating system?
The installation of the OS.
Yeah, so they removed the EHCI driver, which is technical speak for being able to use USB devices when you install Windows. So typically you install Windows 7 by either a USB stick or a CD, and you pull up the menu and you move the mouse and you select your drive and everything. With Skylake, you no longer have the functionality to move the mouse. But motherboard manufacturers in the desktop space have been able to get around this by including the driver inside the BIOS code, inside the AHCI code. So if you enable the option inside the BIOS, you can install Windows 7. But another caveat, you can't install it via USB. You have to use a CD.
Okay, so it's more power efficient. You get more fine control over where you're using your CPU power. They've also said that this is a much better processor for the enterprise. And I'm thinking everything from financial markets to creative professionals. What is that marketing speak, or do you actually see a case for that?
So we've heard along the lines that this processor is perhaps slightly more modular, which when it comes to designing those big multi-core chips, especially for financial and HPC, there could be scope for better performance there. So in the Skylake processors for consumers, there's a small change in the L2 cache of the processor. For the consumer, that doesn't make much of a difference, but it allows certain aspects of the enterprise segment to be boosted. by virtue of this modular aspect, so they can attach more things essentially. And plus, we have heard rumors about AVX 512 coming to Enterprise, and that in itself is a big eater of diarrhea on the CPU. Though that's still unconfirmed because Intel are who they are and they won't pre-announce anything, even to us, unfortunately.
Let's talk about availability. I know they announced two chips first. What chips are out now? When will the rest be out?
How many chips are out now? I'd say none.
None? I thought those two that they announced at the game conference were already out. They're not.
Obviously, when Intel distributes their processors, it goes to distributors, then to the retailers. And when it goes to system integrators, they typically put them in their pre-built systems first.
Right.
Because that gives them the higher margins.
Are there pre-built systems now with Skylake available?
I believe there have been some that have been announced. But it's a bit like hen's teeth right now. But we expect that over the next 3 or 4 weeks. We've been told that Intel has a very healthy stock of the processors that were just released, especially in Skylake S for people who want to build custom desktops. So keep an eye out on the usual retailers over the next 2 to 3 weeks, and they should start filtering through.
How about Apple?
Well, whenever Intel releases a new processor architecture, obviously every laptop under the sun is going to start using it. So I wouldn't be surprised if when we see Apple updates, they're going to get all new Skylake and everything else. If you're thinking that Apple might move some of their ARM architecture into that notebook space, there's a possibility.
Yeah, there've been rumors about that. Yeah, right now they're using Core M in their MacBook.
Sure, Core M still 4.5 watts. It's a bit of a push to put ARM into that thermal space and still get the performance that Core provides. But because Apple owned their ecosystem, both in software and hardware, I'm sure if they wanted to, they could make it work and still get the performance they need. But they might suffer a bit of a retaliation similar to when Core M came to the MacBook, people saying, well, hey, this MacBook is slower than the MacBook Air, but it's thinner. So it's tit for tat in that space.
I understand why Intel compares it to five-year-old computers. Yes, it's going to be faster than your five-year-old. It sounds like it's only slightly better than Broadwell. Is that correct? Is that accurate?
That's correct when we're talking sort of around the 90, 91 watt. When you move down to that sort of 4.5 watt, 15 watt laptop range, when you're relying on, say, video decode, when you're streaming video, there are features of Skylake to help accelerate those. They're fixed function hardware inside the integrated graphics, which will help. As I mentioned, the power arrangement, so being able to turn off parts of the CPU in that sort of, there we go, the 15 watt, the 28 watt in the U series, and the 4.5 watt in the Y series. I think we'll see gains that are different to performance in those markets. So your benefits will be in how you consume your media. If you're wanting a dedicated production device, then you're going to get pretty much the same thing. But if you're going to be consuming content, then what Intel has announced, obviously we still need to test to see if this is
right.
True.
Right.
But on paper, it sounds good. Anything can sound good.
Yeah, everything sounds good on paper. We'll probably get new systems then in kind of mass quantities, not till early next year, it sounds like.
Holiday season.
Holiday season is expected. I wouldn't be surprised if we see laptops on the shelves come October. Obviously, a lot were announced at IFA, and the sort of low-cost models might start appearing end of September, but they expect it to ramp up. So updates for the Dell, updates for HP systems, almost everything you can probably imagine in the next couple of quarters.
Great. And we'll look for benchmarks on AnandTech.com. Thanks to Ian Cutress and the team there at AnandTech, who are doing a great job as always. Ian, thanks for staying up late for us.
Thank you very much, sir. If I may, can I just say hi to Brett Howes? He watches your show and has done for the best part of 15 years.
I know.
He's our laptop editor, so he's the one that's going to be reviewing this stuff.
Nice.
So look out for this stuff as well.
He tweeted he was looking for, I guess he had for a while, a copy of my interview with a 16-year-old Anand at, he said CES, I think it was Comdex in the late 90s. And we never did find it, but if anybody has that in their, you might. Oh, no, you said you threw it out.
It's all gone.
Yeah. So if anybody has it in their archives, let's fire it over to us and we'll get it to your editor. Hey, thank you so much, Ian.
Thank you very much, sis.
All right, take care.
Have a good day.
People might think I'm bald. I'm not. I'm I like to wear
hats. It's just a fashionable hat.
I want to look like that guy at the IFA. I need a Hawaiian shirt, though. Oddly enough, I'm not wearing one today. Coming up, we're going to talk to some scientists who are 3D printing replicas of children's hearts to prep surgeons for life-saving procedures. But first, Ron Richards will perform a life-saving procedure on your email.
Hey, this is Ron Richards coming to you live from the set of All About Android, and I've got a great email productivity tip for you. As those of you who watch All About Android probably know that I'm a big subscriber to the Getting Things Done method, as well as Inbox Zero, live my life by it. And the key thing that I've taken away from Inbox Zero and Getting Things Done ties into how we use our email. Our instinct is to use our email as a to-do list. Do not do that. When you receive an email, immediately either respond to it and then archive it, or move it into another folder to be actioned on later, but don't leave it in your inbox. That's how you end up with a device with a little unread email icon of over 1,000, and you do not want that. I often pair my email with an easy-to-do checklist kind of app like Google Keep, or with an Evernote, or Wunderlist is a great to-do task app. And when I get an email with something I need to do, I read the email, I pop over to my to-do list app, add it to there, and then archive the email, get it out. When you reach Inbox Zero, it is a level of nirvana that I can only describe with a lot of enthusiasm, and I want you to reach it. So practice Inbox Zero, don't use your inbox as a to-do list, and you'll live a much happier life.
Love Ron Richards every Tuesday night on All About Android. The problem with Inbox Zero is it only stays that way for like 5 minutes.
Right. You feel good when it gets to zero, and then it's done.
Well, at least you have many opportunities to do it again and again. Hey, before we get to our life-saving surgery, you heard about Jason Howell and his amazing life-saving. I just want to adventure. I just want to just give a tip of the hat. I'm calling him Jason Spidey Sense Howell. He saved a young man's life miraculously at a pool party. He saw a 4-year-old lifeless at the bottom of the pool, rescued him. His parents performed CPR. Luckily, they were a nurse and trained in CPR. A nurse, and I think her husband was a trainer.
Right.
They knew what they were doing. They saved the kid's great. He's healthy. They did, and of course, this is something everybody should be aware of. They did take him immediately to the hospital because secondary drowning is a real risk after something like that. But I am told the kid is fine. And Jason is very unassuming. And he will never say anything. And he's already mad at me just that I'm mentioning this, I'm sure. But I think we need to give him a little tip of the hat.
Yes, we do.
Because that is a miraculous thing to save.
And we got to, you know, we got to do CPR on know-how or a special.
You know what we're going to do? We're going to bring in CPR trainers. And we're going to on an off day, give everybody in the staff who's going to have CPR training. Because I'm the next to go. So I think it's appropriate.
I thought we were going to get you an AED.
And we're getting
on a drone.
Yeah.
Just landed on you. Poof.
Look at these. These are beautiful. These are actual 3D printed models of children's hearts. We're talking right now with Justin Ryan. He's a researcher at the Phoenix Children's Hospital. And he runs the 3D lab. With him, Stephanie Starks. She's the mother of one of the children. Hello. It's good to have you and welcome.
Hello.
Wow, this is an amazing story. First of all, tell us your story, Stephanie, if you don't mind. Tell us what happened.
Well, I was pregnant with our third child and got the anatomy ultrasound. Everything looked great. My husband and I, you know, did the high five. We have a healthy baby. We've done it. We're so happy. Gave birth a few months later. Turns out she is missing half of her heart. Mm. So she began to struggle to breathe. We were at home, and she closed her eyes, and she stopped breathing.
Oh.
And we called 911. They rushed us to Phoenix Children's Hospital, and she's a couple days old, and the doctor comes out and says she's missing half of her heart. And I had never heard of such a thing. So I'm thinking that I'm surely going to lose my baby.
Yeah.
You can't live without a heart. That's kind of important. So it was living a nightmare. Yeah, that's Gemma. That's my sweet baby. They then introduced us to her cardiologist and said, "Well, we can do surgery. We can help her, and she may even be able to live and have a full life." I literally fell to my knees, could not even imagine that they could do this for me. And they did. So she's had 3 open heart surgeries. She's now almost 2. Yeah, there she is. Aww.
It must be hard to see your baby like that. I can only imagine. Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't want to bring this all back. But she's 2 now. And how's she doing?
Amazing. Amazing. She is thriving. She's talking. She's running. She's jumping.
Oh my God. Wow. Congratulations.
That's her 1-year heart anniversary. Oh. That's her shirt for her 1 year after her first open heart surgery. She's in every way a miracle, but she's really here because of this guy next to me, Dr. Justin Ryan. He's doing incredible life-saving work here, and he's a big reason that I'm able to hug and watch my child grow. They've saved her life and given her an incredibly full life.
Well, we're so happy for you.
Thank you.
Justin, tell us about the procedure. What is it that you do? I take it these are actually...
The one that Padre is holding is actually Gemma's heart.
No.
Oh, yeah, see the missing part?
Wow. Look at that.
Yeah, if you look, there's next to the big red part is a tiny purple part, and that purple part is supposed to be the same size. It just didn't grow. This is actually a fairly, it's kind of blue actually. Yeah, that part you're touching with your fingers to below.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the underdeveloped. That's her right side. Her right ventricle just didn't grow and like it was supposed to. So normally, 20 years ago, these kids were sent home to die.
Yeah. So how do you make this model, first of all?
Yeah, well, each of these comes from an actual patient. So we start with the patient. In Gemma's case, on day 3, she received a CT scan with a contrast agent, which illuminated part of her heart. And if we can get the tech people there, I'm going to try to share my screen can show a CT scan looks like.
You may be able to make a heart model. I doubt very much we're going to be able to do that. Oh, it worked!
Oh, wow, okay.
All right, so... Here's a CT scan. So this is basically a slice right through the chest as I kind of scroll back and forth.
Right.
So these large black areas are the lungs. These central areas are basically the contrast parts or the areas of blood. So if these are a bunch of slices of data, we can kind of stack them one on top of another in order to create a 3-dimensional model.
Wow. Dr. Ryan, I've seen CT scans before. I've seen MRI scans. How much more important is it to have an actual 3D model of the heart for a surgeon?
Well, it gives them more information than ever before. Before, a doctor would have to look at a 2-dimensional CT scan, even though it's a 3-dimensional volume, each of those slices is discrete. So giving them more information than ever before, we perceive helps them out. So holding a heart in their hand before they ever set room in the operating room. So on day 3, Gemma had the CT scan. We produced the model, and then I believe on day 8 is when the first surgery happened. So a doctor actually saw the heart before they were ever in the operating room.
And this is so accurate that they were able to really look at it and kind of plan the surgery and figure out what they're going to do?
Exactly.
What are all these colors? We see so many different colors.
This is not a color of a heart, obviously.
No, obviously not. But I mean, it must mean something to a surgeon.
It does mean something to a surgeon. It means something to a student learning medicine. It means something to a family member. When I, hold a heart up, if I present this to a family and say, this is tetralogy of flow with multiple aortopulmonary collateral arteries, suddenly they gloss over with all that information. Yeah. But if I can say the blue parts are supposed to be oxygen poor, red parts are supposed to be oxygen rich, and the green parts shouldn't be there. Suddenly things start clicking, then you can go into more and more detail, but it's all about information, creating something nice and succinct that conveys information either to a surgeon, to a student learning medicine, or to a family member who is going through a very, very difficult time.
It looks like you do this with other body parts as well.
Yeah. Behind me here is kind of a tray of different anatomies. To show how different technologies work, so the heart models are using a 3D printer that does full color. It's kind of like a resin, but we also do plastic parts, so this is a kind of brain lobe.
Wow.
But then you can do some cool stuff with that. You can create a silicone mold out of that 3D printed brain and cast whatever you want inside there. If it's a ballistics gelatin or a different type of silicone, the possibilities are really endless. Just tons of different anatomies. This is a different 3D printed model printed on an object machine by Stratasys, and it's flexible.
Wow.
So this is an aorta of a 65-year-old person. And what's inside of here are materials of different hardnesses, so representing plaque. So
an
interventionalist can actually go in there and deploy
incredible.
A device to see how anatomy reacts.
Incredible. You use, it looks like a Z-Corp printer there behind you?
Yes, the Z-Corp printer is a big printer. It was about $70,000 when we initially got it. So a bit of a buy-in, but it allowed us to do, you know, incredible models, give physicians more information than ever before. The cool thing about the Z-Corp printer is it does full color. So it allows us to really capture all the information we want to show in one single model.
Were you trained in this, Dr. Ryan? Is this your? Are you a 3D printer expert, or did you have to acquire this skill in the process of doing this?
I'm certainly becoming quite the expert. My background's in animation. I got my undergraduate in digital art. I had a very, very good advisor, Dr. David Frakes, who had this vision for this lab. He brought me in into his engineering team, and then subsequently I got my master's and PhD in biomedical engineering, and I'm the lead research scientist in the lab doing these models.
Is Phoenix Children's Hospital the only hospital doing this, or is it starting to become more commonplace?
It is certainly starting to become more and more commonplace. Right now, though, just a few handfuls of hospitals are doing this. Mayo Rochester has a great program. Children's Hospital Philadelphia, DC Children's are really the big ones right now. Toronto Sick Kids as well. But it is a hefty buy-in. The Z-Corp machine's about $70,000. Some of the more fancier printers, $300,000+. So the challenge is to bring this technology to more and more hospitals. So we have a FlashForge creator, which is more of a maker-style machine, and we're trying to get that machine to produce 80% the accuracy of the $70,000 printer at 2% the cost.
Right.
So we do recognize that smaller hospitals need this technology, but it's a challenge to downgrade basically from the $70,000 to the sub-$2,000 printer.
And Dr. Ryan, it's interesting that you bring up the maker community, because I look at that FlashForge and I look at the resolution of this print. It is absolutely amazing. And the material that it uses is unlike anything I've ever used. And I do a lot of 3D printing. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you could inspire a generation of makers to really get to it. What's important when you look at the quality of prints, when you look at the materials that you want to use, what should we be working on as the maker community to help you? What kind of technology should we develop for your work?
That's a great question. Well, one thing is just to get interested in, and don't be afraid to email your nearest hospital. If you have a printer and you have time, then email the heart center at your local hospital. Email the orthopedics program and see what you can do. But also specifically for the do-it-yourself or the maker, you know, understanding that this print does not need to be the final step. You can go to a casting step. So this brain was 3D printed on a dimension machine, so basic FDM technology, but we made a cast out of it. And this cast allows us to create a mold out of it, but we can cast whatever we want inside of here. If that's plastic, if that's a gelatin material, if it's a silicone. So material properties really open up. So understand that the final model doesn't need to be the direct 3D print.
It could be a cat. It could be a mold.
Well, let's go a little sci-fi here. How long before there's already research into this, we start printing
actual
organs and actual body parts and actual bones?
Wouldn't that be amazing?
It's definitely a challenge, and it's hard to say. Some centers are certainly doing tissues, early organs. I know Rice University has a great program under Jordan Miller, so I'm excited to see what he comes up with. The challenge is, if we visualize just a spherical organ, as you start printing layer by layer by layer, there's a dead area on the inside that no oxygen, no nutrients is getting to. So the challenge is, how can we print vasculature at the same time as we're printing tissue? And that's the kind of great challenge right now that we see. But it's certainly getting there. The other thing is, just like 3D printing, sometimes it's not the final step. Maybe we can print off a scaffolding that we seed with cells. Mm. That might be the best option to get to.
Right, just grow the cells inside of the structure that you want it to take. That's amazing. I have to say, I'm blown away. Not often do we get to combine such a heartwarming story and such an incredible tech story This is one for the books.
Stephanie, I'm sure you're very glad you went to Phoenix Children's Hospital.
Oh, to be, you know, 3 days postpartum, find out that your child may be dying, and then, you know, the cardiologist comes in with pen and paper and tries to draw a heart. Yeah, I took biology in college. I don't remember that much about hearts. And what do you mean the right side didn't grow? It doesn't make sense. Then when Justin comes out with this model, it changes everything. And not just for me. So my daughter's getting older. The right side of her heart is not going to grow back. This is her heart. Right. It's functional, but it's different. But now I can hand this to her. I can show her, this is what your heart looks like. This is what you're dealing with. It takes the confusion away. You know, some of these negative feelings of what's wrong with me now becomes, oh, look, this is what I have to work with. It's incredible. It's completely changed our lives.
And I gave Stephanie the STL, the 3D file of Gemma, and she went to, I think, Shapeways.
Oh, yeah. Look at this.
And she actually
got some jewelry.
Gemma's heart might not be
super
clear.
So I wear her heart.
You literally
my neck
wear her
day.
Heart.
Oh. I literally wear her heart. Yep. It stays by mine all the time.
That is so touching. What is Op Heart before we go?
Well, we are trying to create a clinical trial around this to not just print off models and give them to surgeons, but make sure we understand how they affect the surgery. Do we reduce surgical time? Do we reduce morbidity and mortality? So this clinical trial will be key to showing that. In order to do that, we need to fund it. So Op Heart is a nonprofit group that has two main focuses. One is providing pediatric surgeons with more tools, such as 3D printing. So they're helping to fund the clinical trial. But they also focus on giving families more information than ever before, helping a family understand what hospital has in terms of surgical outcomes. So you know where to best go for your child with a very specific heart issue.
Could you spell the URL? Is it OPHEART?
That's correct.
.org.
Everybody should visit and support Op Heart. I can't thank you enough, Justin and Stephanie, for sharing your story with us. We wish all the best for Gemma. It's such a heartwarming story. It's such a great outcome.
And Thank you so much.
And if anyone wants information on the lab itself or to see more of the cool projects we have specifically, cardiac3dprintlab.com is specific to the lab. And we also have an email on there. If anyone has any questions, feel free to email us.
Well, I'm sure you're going to get a lot of people in the maker community very interested now. Justin Ryan, Stephanie Starks, thanks for joining us on the new Screensavers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really a beautiful story, heartwarming
incredible.
Story.
Wow. Yeah.
Can you imagine as Gemma grows up, this was your heart?
Yeah, you have a picture of your heart, the thing that almost killed you.
Unbelievable. All right, I'm going to compose myself while Becky Worley tells us how to save a little money next time you go shopping online.
Hey, new Screensavers fans, Becky Worley here, and I cover consumer issues for Good Morning America, and in the last little bit, I've noticed a change in the way that we get discounts when we shop online. Used to be that you would go to buy something, and then you would just go into Google and say, promo code The Gap, and you'd get some weird, you know, 742KLB or spring sale or 20 off 5, you know, one of those weird codes that got you a discount on your entire order. Pretty much all of us these days won't buy something without looking for one of those codes. But here's the news. A company called ListTrack makes an assessment of all of the email offers that have been going out to email newsletter lists, and they've determined that those codes have decreased by about 45% in the last couple years. So it's not your imagination. They're a lot harder to find those codes. But there are two new tricks to get them. Now, one, you may know about this one, but just in case, I want to give it to you, and it's called shopping cart abandonment. And what you do is if you want something that's a big ticket item, or let's say that you have a bunch of items that you want to buy for holiday or back to school or a big birthday or something where you have to buy a bunch of stuff from one store, what you do is you go sign into the website, do your shopping, put everything into your shopping cart, and this is important, you have to have been signed in. Because then what you're going to do when everything's in your shopping cart, walk away. Yep, you heard me. Don't buy it. You're abandoning your virtual shopping cart. And what ListTrack found is that the first thing that's going to happen is that the website's going to send you an email. It says, hey, You forgot the stuff in your shopping cart, just letting you know, just trying to be helpful. Then you're going to get a second one. Hey, you don't want that to expire. It'll all just disappear, poof, out of your shopping cart. But what ListTrak says is if you wait for the third email, you are most likely to get a discount code in that third email, giving you a blanket discount on your entire purchase. So, shopping cart abandonment, that's your number one way to get a code if you're not getting them in your email newsletters. Number two way is this little device. Yes, your phone. Turns out that one of the ways that retailers are trying to get new customers is they're going after millennials. And what do millennials love? Their phones so much. It's a relationship. And what the retailers are doing is they're actually putting their discounts into their apps. So, you know, especially the sites that are really competitive, like clothing sites really want to do this, and the big chains. So if you download their app, and you probably might want to, if you really want to take advantage of these discounts, allow push notifications, because what they'll do is they'll send you a push notification that shows up on your alert screen on your phone telling you, hey, we got a sale at the Gap, 20% off, buy it through the app. That's the trick. I'm not saying it's everywhere, but they also have rewards, reward programs built into their apps where they'll track how much you buy and then give you a gift card if you hit a certain threshold of points. So you just have to think like a retailer sometimes. They don't want you to abandon your cart. They want to find those new millennial shoppers. So you got to pretend to be a millennial and shop on your phone. And they're not going to give you the milk for free if you don't buy the cow. In other words, they're not sending those email codes in the email anymore. I'm not sure that metaphor really worked, but I think you're with me here, people. I hope you get a discount the next time you shop online. And you can get more tips like this by following me on Twitter. I'm at B Worley. Thanks for watching.
Thank you, Becky Worley. Scooter X says a shopping cart abandonment is the name of his next band.
I like that.
I like it.
Cover band. Good.
Yeah.
Cover band.
Cover band, yeah. It's time
for a call for help.
Jacob is on the line from Alabama.
There he is.
Nicely dressed.
Nice bow ties. Bow ties are cool.
Thank you.
What the hell is that you got there?
Oh, hi, yes. This is a ferret.
What is your question?
So I make ferret videos at youtube.com/CPTJackFerret or...
Wait a minute, Jack. You're Captain Jack Ferret? No spaces?
All right.
No spaces.
Yeah. Okay. That would be your youtube.com/CPTJACK.
Captain Jack Ferret.
RRET. Captain Jack Ferret. There it is.
Yeah, and there's my video saying thank you guys to 50 subscribers.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's part of my thing here.
Yeah.
My notes. So currently I'm sitting at around 50 subscribers, and I won't grow that. So. My question is, what advice would you guys give to someone like me trying to grow their ferret channel?
I got a ferret. Ozzy, chase rabbits.
That's actually funny because there's a story in China of people giving steroids to ferrets and trying to sell them as what? Shih Tzus?
No, come on. That's
terrible.
Yes,
that actually happened.
How many ferrets do you have?
I have two right now.
Oh, okay. Are they male?
Jack here.
Oh, jeez.
He's my bigger ferret. And he's my first ferret. He's actually where the name came from. His full name's Captain Jack Sparrow.
Right.
But I changed the YouTube name for clarification purposes because this thing is no sparrow.
It's really hard to... first of all, I think in some ways you did the right thing. You can't get much more narrow than a ferret channel.
Right.
But as it turns out, I did a YouTube search for ferrets, and there's 107,000 ferret videos on YouTube. This is not at all unpopular, apparently.
Right.
Who would have thunk it?
Well, if you look at one of my recent videos, you can actually play it. There's nothing in there that's copyrighted. If you look there, you'll see that these guys, even though they're looking calm right now, they are extremely playful and very curious.
So they're cute. Quickly. People would like to. Let's see. This is your most recent video. Okay, yeah. I'll tell you one thing. Stop panning so much. Holy cow!
Yeah, that's a lot of jiggle on that camera.
Wait a minute. Is that a raccoon? What is that?
This is like a Bigfoot video.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I actually got a tripod set up.
Good.
Yesterday.
Oh, I've seen ferrets do this in the tube. Was that your video with the ferrets doing the tube chase?
This is my probably not, because I just got into ferret videos recently.
Apparently, that's a popular thing to do, is have ferrets chase.
Yeah, they're like, ferrets are like extremely playful and curious kittens that never grow up and also like to steal all your things. So they make really good ferret videos.
I mean, wait a minute, they steal your things?
Oh, yeah, they're pack rats.
Yeah.
What do they do with them?
They take them to wherever their hiding spot currently is.
Wow.
You know, well, something else you might want to try is if you've got a camera that can either zoom out a little bit or put a wide-angle lens on it, you may actually find that it gets a little less nauseating for your audience to watch the video.
The new screensavers with 100 more animals.
You know, I think Captain, what do we call you, Captain Jack, or no? That's the ferret.
You can call me Jacob. You can call him Jack, too, if you don't want to add the
Captain Jacob, I think you are a character.
Yes.
And I think we want to see more of you, too. That's the other thing is anybody can do videos of ferrets chasing each other around. I think you need to start making, I don't know, something different, something new, something creative, and incorporating you into this. Maybe we're talking ferret puppet shows. Maybe you could have, I got an idea, ferret tea party.
There we go.
Can you get the ferrets to sit still in a chair?
They would probably jump off.
Yeah, I would put, don't you think, but Madre,
you should be part of the content. You should be part,
of, should the be part of the video.
Because there could be millions of ferret videos, but there's only one you.
Captain Jacob. So I agree with you. I think that's a... You're unique,
yeah.
And I think you, that's one idea. I mean, really, it's hard. There are how many millions of videos on YouTube and how many more hundreds of hours uploaded every second? Very hard to keep, become a YouTube star. And I think that's one thing that we see the YouTube stars and we see people like PewDiePie reputedly making $7 million a year. Mm-hmm. But that's the very thin tip of the iceberg, and most people on YouTube just do it for fun. Now, do you want to make money on this, or you just want to get more followers?
Yes, I do, because ferrets can be sometimes expensive animals. So if I can brighten people's day and entertain them, because ferrets are quite frankly entertaining without me, that would be awesome, because they sometimes do happen to have some very serious medical costs.
Yeah, they can be expensive to have a ferret.
Mm-hmm.
I think better camera work.
Right.
Because nobody's going to watch a video that's moving all over the place. But I also think using your own personality, clearly you've got one. I mean, you've got some stuff. I would be interested in watching Jacob maybe talking about ferrets. It's the same problem as getting your blog notice.
You've got to get above the noise. You have to get above the noise somehow.
It's hard to do.
And actually, something else that you could do that's really cheap is work on your SEO. Your titles right now are a little bit generic. If you, I hate to say it, but you got to go for the clickbait. You got to go for something that will look interesting. So it can't just be, I'm playing with my ferrets. It has to be, look at what this ferret does, or this ferret eats a watermelon. That's what brings people in.
You're awfully good looking. I think that you could have whole... fan base of young female ferret lovers.
And I hope so.
And I think that I don't know how big that number could be, but I think the sky's the limit. I do. I'm serious. I think there's an opportunity here. But I think you, here's what's Tim Street, who is a great video producer, one of the early guys in video podcasts. He did the French Maids video and things. What Tim told me is, the key to successful viral video is combining emotions, not just one emotion, not just humor, not just pathos, not just anger, not just surprise. The more you can combine in a single video, the more people laugh and cry and are surprised and delighted in various things, the better that video is going to do. So creating a viral video is not something you can do programmatically or automatically. Otherwise, people would do it all the time. It's kind of getting lightning in a bottle, but you can make your videos more appealing with, I would say, humor, right? Mm-hmm. What's bigger than humor? Nothing much bigger than humor. What's funnier than a priest holding a penguin in a hat? I mean, that's a joke. That's exactly. A joke waiting to be told. A priest and a penguin walk into a bar. I personify the ferrets. I love what you've done so far with the Captain Jack ferret. That's great. Continue to personify them. put them in fancy outfits. I don't know what it is. Maybe that's a dangerous thing. Ferrets
may not. Fancy tea party. I like the tea party.
I like the ferret tea party. I'm brainstorming. I'm blue sky in here. But it is very hard to get that stuff to happen. But combine humor and other elements, other emotional elements. You want to make people feel. You want to make laughter is the easiest one. And I think you're a good looking fella. I think that there's a lot you could do with this. In fact, I think you're going to have. Look at this guy. Aww. He's the Justin Bieber of ferrets. I really think.
Thank you.
I'm serious. I think you're going to go places, my friend. You could be, you know, the next the ferret king.
You're like Justin Bieber, except I don't want to turn off your video.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate
that. So you're on the right track. People are now watching you. But the problem is, if I went to that page and I looked at those videos, I go, that's nice. Big deal. I want more from you. Put more into it.
Yes, sir. Before, a few things, though. I have to ask, am I the best dressed guest?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Done. Thank you.
And that's only because the pocket square matches the bow tie.
Yeah, this is the only bow tie that I have that has the matching pockets.
You may try a fez, though. I think a fez would go quite well with that.
I like his hair, though. He's got attractive hair. Look, he has a little plaid cap.
Oh, okay. Yes, that works, too. All right.
Oh, my gosh.
Got it. Done.
I feel there's something here. I think we may be seeing a YouTube star in the making
right now.
Captain Jack Ferret. Thank you, Jacob.
That was interesting.
I think we're going to see more of him. So when you compress an MP3, as you know, the way you make MP3 so much smaller, as much as one-tenth the size of the original, is by tearing little bits of music out. The MP3 folks have always said those little bits of music aren't heard anyway. They don't matter. The song sounds the same. Well, we'll find out when we actually play, in a moment, an MP3 made up of the little bits of music torn out of a classic MP3. But first, I want to talk a little bit about ProXPN, a fine sponsor we love. If you are surfing on a public internet site, maybe you're at a coffee shop or you travel and you go to a hotel and you use their internet, that, as you all know, is a very dangerous thing to do. Everybody else on that network, and that means everybody in the hotel, everybody in the coffee shop, can see your stuff. That exposes you not only to, you know, lack of privacy, but to hacking. There's also an issue many people at home worry about their internet service provider spying on what you're doing. Maybe that's six strikes. Maybe you've gotten the first letter or second letter in the six strikes law. There is a way to protect your privacy online, and that's with a VPN, a virtual private network. And we recommend ProXPN. They work with almost any internet connection. It creates a secure encrypted tunnel through which all your online data passes to and fro. Any application that goes online can work with ProXPN. That means your web browser, your email, file sharing, instant messaging. Everything you do online will be hidden from your internet service provider, that open Wi-Fi access point. Disguises your physical location, too, because ProXPN, and I love, you know, I can set up an open VPN at home, but the problem is it's still coming from my house. With ProXPN, it can come from Singapore or Amsterdam or all over the world. They've added more servers. They're adding more servers all the time to speed up performance. And by the way, they listen. We were talking with them and Steve Gibson, and he said, do you log? They say, we log for 2 weeks in case of technical error. He said, that's not good enough, and they stopped logging. They're one of the few places that do not log any traffic at all. No record of your online activity exists at ProXPN. And because they're based outside of the United States, you don't have to worry about U.S. law enforcement rules. Complete privacy, no IPv6 traffic leakage, no DNS hijacking. They are up-to-date, fully protected, and they are getting better all the time. Servers in the U.S., in the U.K., in Asia, all around the world. Specialized software for Windows and Mac gives you advanced controls. Look, you can go to proxpn.com/twit, read all about it. They do have a free version, but here's what I would suggest. Try the premium version. You could try it for 7 days and get no cost to you. And if you use our offer code NSS50, they will give you 50% off the monthly price when you sign up for a year forever. That makes it less than $5 a month with a year subscription. Less than $5 a month forever. If you're not satisfied, of course, 7 days, and you can cancel anytime in that first 7 days with get a full refund. ProXPN.com slash Twitter. And again, use that offer code NSS50 to get 50% off forever. And by the way, they do take credit cards, unlike a lot of VPNs. They'll take Visa. They take PayPal. They take Bitcoin, which I think is really great for total privacy. ProXPN.com/twit. Are you ready to move on? This one's all yours because you know all about this.
We covered this on Know How a while back because we thought it was a fascinating demonstration of what happens in lossy compression.
Now, I remember, in fact, I think we have video of a great bit on the old screensaver. Suzanne Vega stopped by.
That was great.
Her a cappella song, Tom's Diner, was used by the original creators of the MP3 format at the Fraunhofer Institute. In fact, we even talked to the creator, I think it was Klaus Brandenburg, about this. And he said we needed a human voice to make sure that we were reproducing human voices accurately. You can go ahead and show a little bit of this. I'll never forget this moment on the old screensavers.
She has an unearthly voice.
She's
I
gorgeous.
Love this.
So when they made that, when they were making the MP3 format many, many years ago, they used that a cappella version, not the big hit version that had music behind it, but the a cappella version to test the codec. Mm-hmm. That's why these guys, I think, wanted to play with it. Tell me what happened.
Well, what happened was they decided to take all the information that gets left out during MP3 compression. So the reason why you can turn a 50 gigabyte WAV file into a 3 megabyte file is because you're leaving out a lot of stuff. I mean, it's not magic. Yes, there's some compression going on, but you also
it's
have
lossy.
To discard. Right, it's lossy, which means when you play it back, you're not getting the original file. You're getting something that's compressed and something that's reduced. Well, that's great and all, because what they figured out was if we remove the parts of the sound that people can't hear or that aren't really important, then you shouldn't be able to notice the difference between the original and the lossy. And we've kind of come to accept that. Most of us will listen to an MP3, we'll listen to a compressed file off of iTunes or off of Google Music, and it sounds great. And if you play that side by side with a pure copy, an uncompressed, non-lossy version, we won't notice the difference. But it got us thinking about Brian and I, what is actually contained in there? And so we found this research, this project, where they took everything that was taken out and they created a sound file and a video file that we could play.
Here's Ryan McGuire. He did the ghost in the MP3. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for joining us on the new Screensavers.
Hey there.
So you call this Modernist, because that's Tom's Diner backwards.
Not backwards, but yeah, it's an anagram of
anagram.
Tom's Diner.
Close enough.
Yeah, modernist.
Modernist. I love it. What gave you this idea?
I was studying the history of, recorded media and thinking about how all the different previous formats, ways that we've listened to music, have inspired different kinds of music. So vinyl records, for instance, inspired, you know, turntablism and hip-hop, and tapes inspired this entire tradition of experimental tape music that was taking place from the 50s up until, you know, the 70s, 80s. And CDs inspired this this great practice called glitch music. And I was wondering what kind of music you could make out of MP3s. Like, what about MP3s is unique? And the thing that's interesting about MP3s, which you guys were just mentioning, is that all this information gets erased that, previously all of our other formats, historically, we've always been moving towards higher and higher fidelity, but this is the first time that we've had sort of a major format that where we've taken away information and we've opted for, I guess, storage efficiency or storage size instead of audio, like an increase in audio quality. So I thought that was really interesting, and I wanted to try and make some music out of that.
Now, why Tom's Diner?
Well, as we were mentioning, Tom's Diner was sort of that was the litmus test for the MP3. Karlheinz Brandenburg, you know, there's the famous story of him in the Fraunhofer Corporation. He walks out. He's testing his algorithm, and he walks out into the hallway and hears Tom's Diner playing on the radio, and says, "Oh my gosh, this would be really difficult to encode into an MP3." So I thought it was an interesting starting point for this project, because anything should be encoded well by the MP3 format, it would be that song.
It's kind of a neat tie into the old screensavers, because Karl-Heinz Brandenburg was a guest on the old screensavers. He told us that story. We had then Suzanne Vega on singing a cappella, Tom's Diner, which was always one of my favorites. I always loved the a cappella version as much as the remix that became a big hit. But what is, and I love the idea, this is kind of the new glitch music, but really, what does it sound like?
Well, you end up with a lot of sort of breathy sounds, fricatives, and sort of these sort of consonant, these hard consonant sounds.
And these are all the pieces that are being pulled out, so we don't actually hear this.
Is that
in
really
the compressed
fair,
version.
Though? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's material that's both erased and altered by the compression codec.
Right.
So.
It's not merely what was removed. How did you do this? Did you do a, I don't know, some sort of comparison between the original and the MP3?
Yeah, exactly. I did a few different comparisons. I did some Fourier transforms, analysis of both files, of the original and the MP3, compared the frequency content, and then sort of resynthesized it into an audio file. Into a bunch of audio files that were sort of different ways of measuring what gets erased and what gets altered.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'm a PhD student in music composition, and so then I took that as material and went about recomposing it.
I love the video.
It just demands you try to figure out what it is. What's the actual thing?
Like, what is that thing?
Ryan, I love this version. This is my favorite version, the video version, because it also shows you, well, what do you lose when you do video compression?
Right. Wait a minute. Is this the video?
This is the video. This is
from the video?
Well, so I have two different video versions. So this one was the first one that I made, and this is with a filmmaker that I collaborated with, and he made a short film to go along with the piece. And then I also made one that's of the music video from Tom's Diner. So that's the black and white one is the one it's an original thing.
Right, right.
But it's really everything cool. That gets tossed out when you compress that. And then there's another one on the website if you dig a little bit further in that's the Tom's Diner music video, the lost material from that. Yeah,
so
this one.
As I remember from talking to Klaus Heinz, the idea is that the fundamental discovery in MP3s is that the human ear, when it's hearing a predominant frequency, rejects related frequencies. It just doesn't. They say it just doesn't hear them. So once they understood this in acoustic research, they said, well, why even store those additional frequencies if the ear doesn't hear them? You only need to store the predominant frequencies, and you can throw out these kind of, and oftentimes I think that they're resonant or related frequencies, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really clever, and the MP3 algorithm works really well. It's based on how we hear. We have critical bands, which are sort of like frequency bins in our perceptual mechanism. And so if you have two sounds that are very similar in frequency occurring at the same time, you'll pretty much just hear the louder one, and you can get rid of the quieter one, mm-hmm. and most people won't notice that it's gone.
The ear listens, but the brain... The ear hears, but the brain listens.
That's right.
And it's the brain that's rejecting these additional frequencies. The ear hears them, but you don't need them.
Yeah, and it's interesting. When you start to model this process, which is what the MP3 does, it's impossible. You know, you can't have a perfect model, and not everybody hears exactly the same way. And so there's a little bit of approximation that happens, and that's where I think it gets interesting. Is, you know, in theory, the MP3 works. You know, they want us, you know, you would say, oh, it's perfect. It, you don't ever notice that there's anything missing. But in reality, sometimes it erases information that is perceptually relevant. And sometimes you can hear the difference if you know what to listen for.
Ryan, I have to ask this. How do you prefer to listen to your music? MP3, do you like compressed, uncompressed, lossy, non-lossy, vinyl, 8-track?
And maybe more importantly, since you're a composer and a musician, when you release your music, how will you release it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, it depends on the circumstance. So believe it or not, I listen to a lot of MP3s. I'm a Spotify premium subscriber. And, you know, when I'm on the subway, you know, I listen with these earbuds. Mm. And it's totally great for the portability of it is wonderful. But when I'm at home and I really want to listen to something, I usually opt for digital, like high quality digital files, because you know, unless you're getting into really high quality vinyl, really good digital is actually has a better signal to noise ratio, and it's better in a lot of ways. So I like really good digital. I'm actually working on a project right now where I've been investigating sort of a, you know, analog. There's a way in which vinyl records are they're sort of quantized as well on a molecular level. When, you know, we don't think about sort of the little polyvinyl chloride atoms that are all in there. And so I'm kind of toying around with how I'm going to release this music this project I'm working on right now.
Cylinder, musical wax cylinder. That's the answer.
Yeah.
My heart a little lump. I love this, and that you started with this premise that there are musical genres that are created out of the accidental, out of the serendipitous, out of the non-musical creations like glitch music. I'd forgotten about that, but really, artists take their inspiration from a lot of places. The other thing I've started to realize, I'm a big advocate of high-res music, but I've also, you know, I remember, you know, reading about the Beatles and many other artists who were inspired by very tinny, poorly reproduced music they heard by tuning in the airwaves of pirate radio, very distant, and they still got excited about Muddy Waters. They still, absolutely, because there's something in the music that can transcend even poor reproduction.
It's experiential.
It really is kind of, there is no right answer to any of this. And I love playing with the accidental. I think that's really
I think the only thing that really matters is that you use really high-quality gold, non-oxygen cables that cost $5,000 or $6,000 each.
There
that makes the experience.
When did we get Monster as a sponsor?
Oh, I didn't say anything about Monster.
Hey, so this is exciting. I'm really now. Where can we hear these actual MP3s? Or are they MP3s?
Yeah. Well, I have. You can download the uncompressed versions from my Bandcamp page, which is linked from theghostinthemp3.com. But you can also stream it. It's all on there. So then it's compressed when you stream it. So that's. It's got a whole other layer of streaming compression, so it's kind of funny.
You got to do a new recording of the things taken out of the recording of the old recording.
Yeah, I know. It's just like a spiral.
We are so meta right now.
But it gets so in.
Modernist, which is Tom's Diner, as you've never heard it before.
I'm questioning what's real. Is this really what was removed, or is it what was removed from what was removed?
Is this reality?
It continues and it gets pretty deep. The more you dig, the deeper it keeps going.
Ryan, it's really great to talk to you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
I love this idea.
That's great.
Yeah. And where are you? Where's your location?
So I'm at the University of Virginia. We have a PhD in composition and computer technologies. If there's any musicians listening, they should apply. It's awesome.
That's awesome.
And there's more music from this project is coming. I'm working on Fast Car right now, which was another one of the listening test songs. So the great Tracy Chapman song. So I'm recomposing that one. That one's coming soon. And if you follow the project on Facebook, there's more coming soon.
Really neat stuff. GhostInTheMP3.com or follow him on Facebook. Ryan McGuire, thanks so much for being with us on the new Screensavers.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. Coming up, some final questions from our viewers. Robert and I will answer them. And Robert Herron will tell you about the most important thing you can do for your home theater experience.
I'm home theater expert Robert Herron, and you can follow me on Twitter at Robert Herron. I'm going to try to convince you to eventually own an AV receiver, an audio-video receiver. One, it provides a switching platform for all of your AV devices, be it a set-top box like a cable or satellite box, or your Blu-ray player, or your Apple TV, or your Roku, or your stick device. Everything gets plugged into this, including older analog devices, too. The other benefit is that it can provide mobile app support for your iOS or Android device. I'm partial to Yamaha receivers. I love their app, but there are a lot of great brands of AV receivers out there. The audio experience, though, yes, I am talking about powering speakers, and there are several reasons you want to do that. One, your TV speakers will never sound as good as separate components. Even soundbars, as good as some are not a replacement for how good a good surround sound system can sound. So if you have the space, if you're remodeling that room, consider getting speaker wires in the walls, getting an AV receiver. It will not only provide you with a sonic experience that is more than half of the whole home theater experience. It's going to give you the ability then to control and manage all of your home theater devices with better simplicity and ease, and enjoy.
That's Robert Heron, Heron Fidelity, and of course a longtime family member with the Screensavers gang, and it's always great to see him. He's absolutely right, though. An AV receiver is a really nice upgrade.
It gets overlooked a lot.
And they're not that
expensive.
No. They start around $150, $200. I have an Onkyo and I have a Denon in my two different setups. And the Onkyo is great because I can play high-res music back. So I can download files, from HDTracks.com, the Pono music site, put them on a USB key, put it in the front. There's a USB slot. And listen to them right off the USB key. And it's really nice to be able to do that. So and among all the other things you can do with an AV receiver. Robert, it's been great having you on the show.
I always have so much fun. This is a great show.
Well, what a fun show for you to be here on. But we are not done.
No, not at all.
Because it's time for the mailbag.
That just gets better every single time.
Round and round she goes. Where she stops. Oh, my God.
You know,
this is from the Rock of Gibraltar.
Which is important, but even more important is this show runs a little long, and I get hungry towards the end. Oh, well,
Ozzy,
that got Ozzy.
Go get it, Ozzy. He's going to tear that thing up.
That thing's dead.
Yeah, that's gone. Were you hungry at all?
Yes. A can of Dinty more would really help.
I think we just keep this in here forever.
I think so.
In case there's an atomic attack or something, we can... Here's, finally, I got the mail. Here's one for you.
All right.
And one for me. And, yes, I will start because I don't know why. My fiancé and I will be getting... Hello, new screensavers, he writes. My fiancé and I will be getting married, and for our honeymoon, we're traveling to Spain. What fun. We both are really excited for the trip. I want to make sure we're covered, maybe to make calls home or calls to other places while traveling. Fiancé has an iPhone 5S on Verizon. I have an iPhone 6 with AT&T. Is it better for me to look into international plans our carriers offer or for me to find a local carrier in Spain that can sell us a SIM? Do you have an opinion?
I know things have changed, but I know that when I was still actively internationally traveling, it was never a good idea to try to get an international plan from a U.S. carrier. It was far too expensive, especially if you were expecting to use it a lot.
We, Lisa and I are in a similar situation. I have an AT&T phone as well as a T-Mobile phone. She has a Verizon phone. We both bought international packages. Verizon's is quite expensive.
Oh, yes.
AT&T is not cheap either. I think the highest level was 800 megabytes, which is nothing.
Yeah.
And that costs, more than 100 bucks. So you can do it. In fact, I would do it on one phone only because it's nice to have that as a backup. I wouldn't use it. Get 250 megabytes. Very important on both those phones to turn off data roaming. That's the thing that will allow you to use your phone data internationally, and that's the biggest risk. That's what will really cost you money. For occasional phone calls, I wouldn't live on the phone, but for occasional phone calls, you can get an international calling plan that will allow you to take emergency calls for a reasonable amount of money. You know, I always bring now a T-Mobile phone with
exactly.
me.
Exactly. If that AT&T phone is unlocked, you can get a T-Mobile prepaid SIM, pay $30 for the month, and it will give you access to international texting, so that can be your lifeline.
Free international texting, free but slow 2G international data. Calls are 20 cents a minute from most areas, certainly Spain. 20 cents a minute is not bad. Now, I can tell you right now, the Verizon phone will work with a T-Mobile SIM.
Yes.
Verizon does not like to lock their SIM cards, so you could put a T-Mobile SIM in that Verizon phone. Keep the AT&T phone. If the AT&T phone is locked, you can also go to AT&T and say, please unlock this. I'm traveling internationally. AT&T's rules allow you to get the phone unlocked by AT&T if you've had it for 6 months and you're in good standing. So that would be also another way to get that unlocked. Then you could put a Verizon SIM. In both cases, though, you need an unlocked phone to use a SIM from Spain. If you want to check out the data plans in Spain, Prepaid with Data is a great wiki. It's prepaid. The URL's long, prepaidwithdata.wikia.com. But if you Google prepaid with data, they have country by country who the various carriers are, how much they charge for data, things like that.
I think in Spain it's going to be Orange is the one that you're going to want to use. And the nice thing about that is in the airport, as you land in Spain, you can just buy a SIM. Or in the train station, you can buy a SIM. They really are everywhere.
You're going to get a different number.
Yes.
So you'll have a Spanish number. You know, what you're going to need to do is email home and say, I have a Spanish number. Here's the number to call. I would keep one phone on the original U.S. plan And maybe just buy some international calling and international data for that phone. The other phone, I think a T-Mobile SIM is a great idea.
Oh, absolutely.
I keep a T-Mobile phone at all times just for international travel because they really knock it out of the park on that one.
But you're right. Your first step was right, which is make sure you turn off international roaming because you will get killed by roaming charges.
If you do get a bad bill, you can call them. Sometimes you can negotiate out of it but because they understand it's unexpected.
Yeah.
But you might have to cry.
You will have to cry because it's not as if they're charging you that. That's what they get charged by the other carrier.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You're next.
Let's do one. So I've got a question here about Office 365 subscriptions. I get this from Giles. He says, I'm not able to use my subscription 365 Office account via browser on my new Windows 10 system without opening up a Microsoft account. I followed advice creating a local account to keep my system as free of the Microsoft cloud as possible. I'm counting the days when my other computer, a Windows 7 laptop, will be forced to upgrade, creating the same problem. If I say yes to an account, are my systems and my privacy going to be swallowed up by the big, bad Microsoft? A big fan.
Gilles, you already have a Microsoft account or you wouldn't have a 365 subscription, right?
Right. I understand. There's a lot of things that Microsoft are doing ham-fisted. Oh, by the way, your hopes of staying safe from that by being on a Windows 7 system, yeah, that's gone. You've probably already installed the updates that allows Microsoft to do the same data collection that they do on 10. Just saying, you're probably going to want to do a little research on that. But if you've got an Office 365 account, they already have your information. So you're not really adding a lot of privacy simply by refusing to use the account login.
I think some of the privacy concerns about Windows 10 are overblown.
Yeah.
The privacy concerns on Windows 7 and 8 are way overblown.
Right.
So what Microsoft did, and you should watch Windows Weekly to find out more about this. What Microsoft did, it was not, first of all, a critical update. In one case, it was a recommended update. In one case, it was an optional update. Most people, I don't know about you on Windows, always do critical updates. And I don't want to scare people away from that. Do critical updates. And then we'll review or ignore recommended and optional updates, mm-hmm. right? I very rarely do recommended or optional updates. It's only then that you will install the special customer experience advisor that Microsoft puts on now 7, 8, and 10. And that's telemetry. I don't think it's a privacy invasion. I don't think Microsoft has any interest in that. What it does is it sends back information about how you use your computer, what programs you run, and so forth, so that Microsoft knows. For instance, one of the reasons they killed Windows Media Center is because their telemetry told them no one was using it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a handful of people were using it. It helps them. The customer experience helps them make a better version of Windows. It's optional. You have to agree to it. You don't have to do it. People were saying, oh, it's pushed to my system via updates. As I said, it's not ever automatically pushed. It's part of recommended or critical, non-critical updates, optional updates. I think I install it because I think I want Microsoft to make Windows better. And I think the how I use Windows is valuable information, but you don't have to opt into that. And I have to say, even on Windows 10, I know, Steve Gibson, for instance, said, don't use Windows 10. I'll never use it under any circumstances because it's spying on me. I don't know what's the hazard. What are people worried about? Are they worried that Microsoft is going to sell your information to the police? I don't understand what they're worried about.
They're worried about the worst possible scenario. And
if
you look at the EULA, I mean, you could interpret it to mean, well, they now own everything you do and they can sell your information against all advertisers, which I guess they could.
First of all,
it would be stupid. They'd go out of business.
This drives me nuts. Yeah, first of all, they're not going to do anything that's going to get them out of business. They're already under scrutiny for this. So what if Google or Microsoft or Facebook gives information about me to advertisers so that I can get better ads? I want better ads. We don't need to do that because we already know what you're interested in. You're a geek, so we don't have to track you. But I don't think it's unreasonable for companies to try to give you ads that are more for things you're interested in. I don't think there's any real risk. People will bring up the risk that, well, what if the insurance companies get a hold of what you're eating? You know what? Trust me. Get life insurance. They will do everything they can to find out everything about you. They give you questionnaires. They'll ask the questions three times. They'll have a nurse come to your house and get blood work and everything. And if you in any way misrepresent it, they hope you will. Because then when you die, they can say, well, you know what? You said you didn't smoke. And I can see that cigarette plainly in your hand. And they can deny you any insurance benefits. They don't need information from Microsoft. They get information already. And believe me, you don't want to lie to an insurance company because they can deny insurance as a result of it. I think this is really overblown.
It's overblown.
It's a straw man argument. I hear it a lot from many of our hosts, John C. Dvorak, Steve Gibson. And, you know, all I can say is I don't see the problem here. People yell at me. They say, well, you're just not, you just don't believe in privacy. I believe in privacy.
Well, it's the slippery slope argument. It's like, well, yeah, everything is a slippery slope. And yes, I don't want to make fun of you if you're paranoid about security. That's fine. That's absolutely, you're right. But for me, what I give up versus what I get by giving up that little tiny bit of information, I get back so much more. So much more.
And here's my security concern is that people will no longer accept Windows updates in 7 and 8 because they've heard, oh, Microsoft puts spy software in the update. And that is a genuine security risk because you're not doing updates. Now you're a security vulnerability. And I don't care if you're dumb enough to do that, that's your problem. The problem is your insecure computer is causing problems for the rest of us on the internet by spreading viruses, by participating in DDoS attacks, by sending spam mail. So it really bugs me because I think what happens is people hear this and they say, well, I'm not getting any more updates from Microsoft. And that's the worst thing you can do.
There's only one answer. Unplug your computer from the internet and start running DOS.
You want to be safe.
Let's do it.
Don't get online. You want to be private. Don't get online. You want to not have... And then you have a glorified calculator. I think we live in a world where you're going to be online. People, you know what? Use your Microsoft account when you log into Windows. It's okay. It's really okay. What is Microsoft going to do? What is it that they are worried about that Microsoft's going to do to you? What? They're all straw man arguments or this slick camel's nose under the tent. And I just don't see it. Yeah. Anyway, I know I'm the only one that thinks this. So.
Trust Uncle Leo.
No. You should decide for yourself, but I want you to hear both sides. Yeah. That's really the bottom line. I'm not telling you what to do, but I do want you to hear both sides of this argument. Father Robert, you are great. I love having you here. Host of This Week in Enterprise Tech, Know-How, Coding 101, Before You Buy, and a regular all over the network. We're going to send you out on more and more adventures out in the real world covering big events.
I'll be covering InterDrone in just a couple of days.
I'm excited
about
that.
So we're going to find out. Yeah. And it's not just a bunch of toys. These are the people who actually want to sell agricultural and enterprise usage of drones.
He is the drone father, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to see the new screensavers, please, there's many ways you can do it. We record the show around about 3 p.m. Pacific time. From our studios here in Petaluma on a Saturday afternoon. That's 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. You can always watch the live stream at twit.tv. If you'd like to be in studio, email tickets at twit.tv. We love our live studio audiences, and we'd love to have you in the audience the next time and you're in Northern California. If you can't watch live or be here live, we make on-demand versions available after the fact on our website, twit.tv/NSS, and on all the podcast apps, you know, iTunes and Xbox Music. You can even listen to us on your Zoom. If you want, just subscribe because this is one show you don't want to miss. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, Padre. We'll see you next time on the new Screensavers. Bye-bye, everybody. Woo!